afternoon. Welcome. On behalf of the Environmental Law Institute and our endangered environmental laws, I'd like to welcome you to our panel discussion. The discussion is on the upcoming Supreme Court case of Summers v. Earth Island Institute. The case is going to be argued next month on October 8th. We'd like to thank you for coming to hear the panelists, and I'd also like to thank those of you who are on the phone who have called in. Before we begin, I just had a couple of reminders. The callers on the phone are muted, but if you have any questions, you can email them to Marcia McMurrin, M-C-M-U-R-R-I-N, at eoi.org. For those of you in the room, we have bathrooms down the hall to the right, and there are keys on the table just outside this room. I'd like to start by introducing our panelists. Our first panelist to my right is Amanda Leiter, an associate professor at Catholic University and a former visiting professor at the Georgetown University Law Center. She holds a B.S. from Stanford University, an M.S. from the University of Washington, and a J.D. from Harvard Law School. She has clerked in the District of Massachusetts on the D.C. Circuit and at the Supreme Court, where she worked for Justice John Paul Stevens. Before becoming a professor, she spent 2 years as a Clean Air litigator at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Our second panelist, to Amanda's right, is Scott Nelson. He's a staff attorney with Public Citizen, where he's practiced since 2001. Before that, he was a partner in a D.C. law firm of Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin, if I said that correctly. He holds undergraduate and law degrees from Harvard University, where he was the president of the Law Review. He's also a former Supreme Court clerk. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Byron R. White. And his practice at Public Citizen centers on civil litigation and civil and criminal appellate practice. Finally, to Scott's right is Damian Schiff. He's a staff attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation in Sacramento, California, where he's worked on a number of Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act cases, involving such things as species listing, critical habitat, and the successor cases to Rapanos v. United States. He received his undergraduate degree from Georgetown University and his JD from the University of San Diego School of Law. He's a former law clerk to the Honorable Victor J. Wolski at the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. I'm going to start with just a brief overview of the factual history of this case before we turn to our panelists for discussion of the questions presented to the Supreme Court. And of course, we'll have plenty of time for questions for the audience following our panelists' discussion. In brief, this case arose out of a challenge brought by environmental groups to certain regulations promulgated by the U.S. Forest Service under the Forest Service Decision-Making and Appeals Reform Act, otherwise known as the ARA. The regulations exempt certain Forest Service actions, namely those categorically excluded from environmental analysis under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, from notice, comment, and administrative appeals. In 2003, a coalition of environmental groups filed suit in California's Eastern District. They asserted both a facial challenge to the regulations and a challenge to application of the regulations to a proposed timber sale project in Sequoia National Forest in California, known as the Burnt Ridge Project. They also asserted additional claims against other ARA regulations that aren't at issue here. After the groups filed their complaint, but before the court heard the case, the group settled their claims with the Forest Service with respect to the Burnt Ridge Project. So the case went forward as a facial challenge to the regulations. In 2005, the district court issued its ruling upholding the group's facial challenge and striking down the regulations at issue here. The court also issued a nationwide injunction against their implementation. The court found that the environmental groups had standing to challenge the rules based on a declaration by a member of one of the groups that he uses and enjoys the national forest, and that the challenge regulations had denied him the notice and the opportunity to comment and appeal certain Forest Service decisions. The court also found that the facial challenge was right, even though the underlying timber sale issue had been settled, because the challenge regulations were final and they had been applied, enforced on numerous occasions. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit affirmed in part and reversed in part. The court found also that the environmental groups had standing, based on both personal and procedural injury. The Ninth Circuit agreed with the district court that the facial challenge to the two regulations at issue here was right, because those regulations had already been applied to the Burnt Ridge Project, even though that project had settled. And the court also found that settlement of that project did not affect the rightness of the regulations, as the record remains sufficiently concrete to allow the court to review their application to the Burnt Ridge project. The court did reject as unripe other challenges that the environmental groups had brought that had not yet been applied in any particular case. On the merits, the court held that the two regulations at issue here were inconsistent with the ARA and upheld the district court's nationwide injunction against their implementation. The government appealed this case to the Supreme Court, and that brings us to today's seminar. I'm going to turn to Amanda to give an overview of the questions presented. And just to note that the merits of the court's ruling striking down the regulations are not up for review.
All right. So I'm going to wear two hats. I'm going to start by going through and giving you some sense of what the government has argued in the three questions presented. But in the interest of full disclosure, I submitted an amicus brief on behalf of a variety of law professors on the side of the respondents. On the justiciability issues. So at the end of my remarks, I'll explain why I think the government is wrong on all of these questions presented. But first, I'll try to be neutral. So to give you a sense of the questions presented, the government raised four issues. So first of all, they suggested that these two procedural regulations were not themselves proper subjects of review. As distinct from the Burnt Ridge project to which they were applied. Then second, they asked whether the respondents had established standing to challenge these procedural regulations. So assuming that the procedural regulations are proper subjects of review, have the respondents actually established standing to challenge them? Third, they asked about the effect of the settlement of the Burnt Ridge controversy. So did the respondents challenge, assuming it was proper at the outset, did it remain proper and justiciable once the Burnt Ridge controversy was settled? The fourth issue, which I won't be discussing, but which I believe Scott may touch on, was whether the Court of Appeals erred in affirming the district court's nationwide injunction, as opposed presumably to an injunction that applied only in the Ninth Circuit. I think it is noteworthy, just to underline what Lisa just said, that the government does not raise the merits at all before the Supreme Court. So you can conclude what you want from that. My conclusion, wearing my advocate's hat, is that they didn't have much of an argument with respect to the lawfulness of these regulations, but they want them reinstated. So they've brought these justiciability arguments to challenge the Ninth Circuit's decision. In lieu of any sort of merits arguments. All right, turning to the first question presented, I'm going to give you an overview, very brief overview, of what the government is arguing here. This, in my view at least, is the really important question presented, and this is the place where a ruling in the government's favor would have fairly substantial implications for access to the courts for a lot of environmental cases. The government has two basic arguments why, in its view, these procedural regulations are not, quote-unquote, proper subjects of judicial review. First, they say that the Supreme Court has repeatedly held, quote-unquote, repeatedly held, under a ripeness rubric, that pre-enforcement review of agency regulations is unavailable unless one of two circumstances is met, unless first Congress has said something in the governing statute making pre-enforcement review available, or second, the regulations would impose serious penalties for violations so that regulated entities subject to the regulations risk these penalties if they don't comply immediately. In that circumstance, the Supreme Court has been quite clear that the regulated entities may seek pre-enforcement review so as to avoid this difficult choice of either complying with onerous regulations or risking these severe penalties. So the government concedes that pre-enforcement review is available in those two circumstances, where Congress has authorized it or where there are serious penalties for violations of the regulation. But they assert that there is no pre-enforcement review absent those two circumstances, so sort of a flat rule against pre-enforcement review. And then they say something even, I think, a little more curious, switching hats for a second. They say, After the agency has applied the regulations in a concrete setting, then, of course, you can obtain review of the regulations, but even in that circumstance, the government says the only thing that is the proper subject of judicial review is how the agency applied the regulations to the challenged project. So essentially, you can never get facial review of regulations. You can only get review as the regulations have been applied in a particular circumstance. So applying those principles to the two challenge regulations here, they say that 215-4A and 12-F are only reviewable, quote, within a challenge to a specific agency project. The implication being, of course, that now that the controversy over the Burnt Ridge project has settled, there is no circumstance within which to review application of these two regulations, and therefore there is essentially nothing for the court to review. Turning to the second question presented, this is sort of going on parallel tracks here. This is assuming that the two regulations are proper subjects of review. Did the respondents establish standing to challenge them? Here the government concedes that the respondents established standing. Obviously, the government doesn't have authority fully to concede this, but the government says that in its view, the respondents did establish standing to challenge the Burnt Ridge project and application of these projects to Burnt Ridge, because the respondents said enough, essentially, about their use of the Burnt Ridge area. And just to allude back to my first slide, which was up at the beginning, that was the closest I could get to photos of the area in question. It's a huge acreage in Sequoia National Forest that burned, and now there was a timber sale, salvage timber sale, to allow logging, essentially, of the burned trees. So the government says you've said enough about, you respondents have said enough about your use of this area. We're convinced you have alleged an injury in fact, essentially, as a result of the Burnt Ridge timber sale and our application of these procedural regulations to that timber sale. But you have not said enough about any other areas that you might use that might subsequently be affected by application of these same procedural regulations. So essentially, they say now that the Burnt Ridge controversy has settled, you haven't said enough about any other injury in fact to give rise to standing to challenge the procedural regulations more broadly. They also take on something that the Ninth Circuit did that is, again, wearing my advocate's hat, I agree is somewhat questionable. The Ninth Circuit premised its standing analysis on the fact that respondents generally file a lot of administrative appeals to U.S. Forest Service action, and the Ninth Circuit said the mere fact that these procedural regulations prevent the respondents from filing those administrative appeals is enough to give them standing to challenge the procedural regulations. The government says the Supreme Court has noted that procedural injury like that is generally not cognizable unless the party alleging the procedural injury also alleges that the absence of the required procedure threatens that party's concrete interests in some sort of on-the-ground area or some forest that they regularly use or something like that. And so implicit in the government's critique on this point is the suggestion that the respondents did not allege enough about how their procedural injury would give rise to concrete harms in areas other than Burnt Ridge. The final question presented that I'm going to talk about is this third question presented, which really is tied closely to the first. The suggestion in this question is that by virtue of settlement of the Burnt Ridge controversy, the court essentially mooted the claims about these two procedural regulations. And if the court were to accept the government's view in the first question presented, namely that there is no such thing as a facial challenge to regulations like this, there can only be a challenge to the regulations as they were applied in a particular circumstance, then the answer to this third question presented would sort of follow directly from that conclusion. If there was only ever an as-applied challenge from the outset, then as soon as the controversy over the particular area was resolved, there is no more issue for the court to address. So in my view, at least, the first and third questions presented really sort of rise and fall on this single issue of whether there is such a thing as a facial challenge to procedural regulations. So just to summarize quickly, that's the essence of the government's justiciability argument. In the first question presented, as I said, they say that the respondent's facial challenge was never judicially cognizable, that the court only ever had jurisdiction to review these procedural regulations as applied to the Burnt Ridge project. Following directly from that, in the third question presented, they suggest that because the Burnt Ridge controversy is then resolved, any claim about misapplication of the regulations to Burnt Ridge is necessarily moot, and so there's nothing there for the court to resolve. And then finally, on this parallel track with respect to the second question presented, the government says that respondent's standing also was tied to the Burnt Ridge controversy, and so in the absence of that controversy, essentially there is no injury. Respondents have suffered no injury that would allow the court to redress their situation. All right, in the last couple minutes, I just want to give you my take on these three issues. First, on the question of broad or facial challenges to agency regulations or policies, in my view, the Supreme Court has said two things that limit the availability of these challenges. First, they're presumptively unripe before the policy or regulation has been applied in a particular circumstance. The court has looked for a concrete setting that helps to sort of flesh out both the way that an agency is likely to apply its policy in a particular circumstance and the contours of the controversy that the plaintiffs are raising. So that is, of course, unless there are significant penalties, as we said, or unless there's some sort of congressional authorization of pre-enforcement review. But the court has suggested that we need application of regulations to a concrete setting before we can get a broader facial review of those regulations. And the second limit the court has set relates to standing. They've said that plaintiffs can't establish standing to challenge broad regulations or policies like this based on purely historic application of the policy. They said this most clearly in a case called Lyons, which involves the Los Angeles Police Force's chokehold policy. And they said to a plaintiff who had suffered from a chokehold, you have a past injury as a result of this policy, but you haven't shown us enough about your likely future injury from application of this chokehold policy. Essentially, we don't believe you are going to be a victim of a chokehold again in the future. So the language that comes from that case is that a plaintiff seeking to challenge a broad policy like this may allege a historic injury, that's fine, but they also must allege that they face a real and immediate threat, in quotes, of some future injury. So here, in my view, the respondents have met both of these requirements. So first of all, I think the government sort of mischaracterizes the facial claim here as a pre-enforcement challenge. It's not a pre-enforcement challenge. It's a challenge to a policy that has been enforced in a particular location or been applied in a particular location. And it just so happens that the controversy over that application has passed. But we have a concrete setting. We have all the indications that we need of how the government is likely to apply its policy. The contours of the dispute are well fleshed out by the Burnt Ridge controversy, right? It serves as an adequate illustration of what the government intends to do. And the fact that it has been resolved, in my view, doesn't change the fact that this is not a pre-enforcement challenge, that the ripeness concerns here are not the same as they would be in a true pre-enforcement challenge. My second point, again, with my advocate's hat on, is that the respondents here premise their standing. If you look through their affidavits, they say a lot about Burnt Ridge, but they also say a lot about their regular use of other national forests, a lot in a fair amount of detail about their regular use of other national forests, places where there are likely to be comparable salvage timber sales, comparable projects that will be exempted from procedural requirements as a result of these two challenged regulations. And so they do, in my view, allege a real and substantial threat of imminent future injury in each of these areas, if the government is allowed to continue to rely on its on these challenged procedural regulations. So in my view, those two, that analysis essentially answers the first question presented. The respondents here waited until these policies had been applied in a concrete setting, and they alleged not just past injury, but a real and immediate threat of future injury. And therefore, they established that their facial challenge was ripe from the outset and that they had standing from the outset. And I'll just note here that the court has never said that facial challenges are entirely unavailable absent congressional authorization or these substantial penalties for violations. The court has instead set limits on pre-enforcement challenges, as I said, but there has never been a holding that facial challenges are presumptively unavailable. So in my view, this facial challenge was right from the outset. Respondents had standing from the outset. And then I don't think, frankly, that the settlement of the Burnt Ridge controversy should change that analysis at all. The controversy still serves as an adequate illustration of the way that the Forest Service intends to apply these regulations, so it still satisfies the ripeness concern that we need a concrete setting in which challenged regulations have been applied. And as I said, the affidavits on standing talk not just about Burnt Ridge, but about all of the other areas in which the Forest Service is likely to apply these challenged regulations. So I don't think settlement of the controversy should change our analysis about the justiciability of this facial challenge at all. So in my view, the facial challenge was ripe from the outset. Respondents had standing from the outset, and it remains ripe, and they continue to have standing. The final important point that I just want to make briefly is that even if the court disagrees with the analysis that respondents do of their standing based on particular details in the affidavits, or of the ripeness of the controversy based on, you know, circumstances peculiar to this case about how the agency has applied things, the court can nevertheless reach the conclusion that this controversy is unripe or that the respondents don't have standing based on its historic standing jurisprudence and its historic ripeness jurisprudence. So I think an important takeaway is that it would really be quite a novel holding and quite a sweeping holding to adopt the government's view here that facial challenges are presumptively unavailable. There's no particular reason to do that on the facts of this case. Even if, in this case, respondents' affidavits are inadequate, for example, existing standing jurisprudence gives the court more than enough room to say that and dismiss the case. There's just simply no need to adopt a presumptive bar against facial challenges, and as I'm sure many of you are aware, such a presumptive bar would impose a real limit on access to the courts for those challenging environmental regulations who are not themselves regulated entities, do not themselves face significant penalties for violation of the regulations. So I'll stop there.
Well, before I begin, I want to say that I agree with virtually everything that Amanda has said throughout this case, and it goes to show what a great thing it can be to have an amicus curiae. Or however you choose to pronounce that phrase. The other thing, just to preface my remarks, like Amanda, I got involved in this case only once it reached the Supreme Court. A little earlier than she did, I got involved at the opposition to cert stage, so that, you know, to the extent that, as sometimes happens, there are twists and turns in litigation where it starts looking different and the question at the higher level becomes a very abstract legal one. That's the perspective at which I'm looking at it, as opposed to the more nitty-gritty issues that were present in the district court, including a number of other challenges besides the ARA procedural challenge, which has become the sole focus, really, of the case on appeal. And also, just to illustrate how abstract the case is, the slide that Amanda showed was the first glimpse that I had had of the Burnt Ridge fire or its aftermath. But with that kind of preface, the way I see the case, and I'm not going to sit here and sort of rehash the arguments in my brief, or our brief, I should say, for one thing, because I think Amanda has already outlined what the basic arguments are, and second, I think that you know, if anybody wants to see the arguments, they can obviously refer to the briefs themselves. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about the potential significance of the case, and in particular, the kinds of ripeness arguments that the Solicitor General is advancing in the case. And, you know, what started out to be a case, you know, that when it was filed, I think probably did focus mostly on a particular timber sale. You know, that case has now become the centerpiece of an effort by the Department of Justice to erect another procedural obstacle in the way of citizens and environmental and public interest groups that are challenging agency action, and in particular the promulgation of regulations. And in particular, having I think taken standing a long ways and perhaps as far as they can kind of go with it in the Supreme Court as an obstacle for those kinds of groups, they're now seeking to make ripeness a much more difficult hurdle to overcome. And in some ways, I think if their argument is accepted, in many kinds of cases, a more difficult hurdle to overcome than standing. And I think that those of us sitting in this room have kind of gotten used to the requirement in the D.C. Circuit of Sierra Club of, you know, putting in your affidavits that show the concrete adverse effect of the agency's action on some member of your organization. And, you know, whether or not you've met that obstacle in particular cases sometimes is still a significant area of contention, especially as we learned last year in cases where the issue is the statistical likelihood of future injury. But, you know, there aren't really, I think, in that area, a whole lot of major legal questions. It's become a question of looking at those affidavits and seeing if they're specific enough. And the fact of the matter is, in many instances, environmental and citizens groups can fairly readily identify a member of their group who can claim sufficient adverse effect from an agency action to get by the standing hurdle. But the ripeness arguments that the government is making in this case would be a much more formidable and indeed virtually insurmountable hurdle for plaintiffs in certain types of cases, because they basically would preclude any effort to do a facial challenge to a regulation by anyone other than someone who's directly regulated and faces the possibility that they will be the subject of sanctions or penalties if they don't comply. You know, I think that to understand how significant a change that would be in the practice in the lower courts, you have to kind of look at the fact that in the Supreme Court has really said relatively little on the subject of ripeness, particularly as compared to standing, I think as compared to mootness, and as compared to other jurisdictional issues. Their ripeness jurisprudence mainly, still the major precedent is the Abbott Labs and Toilet Goods trilogy of cases from, if I'm not mistaken, 1968. Where they took the view that a facial challenge to an agency regulation was ripe for review in advance of any application of the regulation, provided that that the plaintiff could show that immediate judicial review was called for by consideration of two factors. The first, the degree to which the issue was fit for judicial review, which basically means, is it a legal issue that can be decided by a court at this point, or is it really an issue with a lot of factual uncertainty to it that has yet to be fleshed out in ways that make it hard to decide the case at this point. And the second is, if there are factors that suggest that the issue may not be as crystallized as one might like for judicial review, is there nonetheless some hardship to the plaintiff that would be specifically attributable to a failure to review the issue now? And the hardship that they focused on in the Abbott Labs case was the possibility that the plaintiff would have to either comply with the regulation and therefore incur significant costs, or not comply and thus risk being faced with penalties. But they didn't suggest in Abbott Labs that was the only type of hardship that would allow review, nor indeed did they indicate that hardship in that sense was an unalterable requirement. And aside from that, the court really had said very little about ripeness in intervening years, other than in a handful of cases they have declined to hear challenges as unripe, usually because of some consideration that led them to say, you know, we don't think that this issue has been fully fleshed out enough for us to resolve it as a legal matter. And the lower courts, on the other hand, and in particular the D.C. Circuit, have developed ripeness doctrine in a very large body of case law. And I think Damien will discuss this a little later. In particular, what the D.C. Circuit has done is to focus primarily on the question of fitness for review, and to say, in general, that if a challenge presents a legal issue that is appropriate for judicial resolution, that doesn't require the consideration of facts that are specific to a particular application of the regulation, so that if your claim is the regulation on its face contradicts the statute, as in this case, or if your claim is the regulation was promulgated without notice and comment rulemaking, which is required, as in many challenges, those types of challenges really don't depend on the facts of some specific application to the regulation of the regulation, and the lower courts have generally said in those cases we don't see an interest counseling that we hold off on review, and therefore we're going to go ahead without requiring much of a showing, if any, of specific hardship. And what they've done is treated the two as, and again, I think Damien is going to talk more about this, as kind of a balancing test. The more fit for review it is, the less hardship you need to show. If it's a little less fit for review, but you can show some real practical harm that you'll suffer if you don't get review now, then you get more in the way of review. And, you know, that's the way I think those of us who practice administrative law, especially in the courts of appeals, have long viewed ripeness. But in this case, the Department of Justice is seizing really principally on some dicta in one Supreme Court decision, National Wildlife Federation v. Lujan, which was the case where the plaintiffs sought to challenge what they referred to as the Interior Department's land management program, which was not a specific agency action or even a specific agency regulation, but just a whole kind of what they characterized as a way of behaving by the agency. And the Supreme Court said, you know, that's not an agency action. That's not reviewable under the APA. But in the course of saying that, Justice Scalia happened to mention the concept of ripeness and said, you know, in passing, that in most cases a challenge to a regulation is not a ripe challenge to a final agency action in the absence of some specific application of the regulation that's being challenged. The major exception being if the plaintiff faces the dilemma of compliance versus facing enforcement action that was discussed in Abbott Labs. And what's really going on in this case is the Justice Department's effort to transform that piece of dicta by Justice Scalia, which I suspect may very well reflect Justice Scalia's views, into what they characterize as a long-established doctrine that facial challenges to regulations are not available by anyone other than a regulated entity that faces an enforcement action if they wait for an as-applied challenge. In addition to really, I think, making facial district court challenges to the issuance of regulations by environmental, other public interest, and citizens groups essentially impossible, the government's issue poses some dilemmas, because in this type of case, at least there are possible other as-applied challenges that one can imagine. I mean, the government concedes that had the Burnt Ridge project not been settled, the issue of the validity of this regulation could be litigated in the context of that timber sale. And, there might be other timber sales that will arise where a similar challenge can be made to the lack of notice and comment. And presumably, if the Supreme Court were to rule against us in this case, someone challenging the regulation in that context would not want to settle the case in a way that would moot their ability to challenge the regulation. But there could be other cases where the existence of a quote as applied challenge would be very problematic. One of them that occurred to me in thinking about this, and although many people in this room might not be troubled about the unavailability of a facial challenge in this particular case, I think it's sort of a striking illustration. The challenge to the roadless rule that the state of Wyoming and its supporters in the other side of the public interest world have taken on, that's an APA challenge on its face to a regulation. If a facial challenge to that regulation is not available, would there really be even the possibility of an as-applied challenge? After all, that's a rule that says the government is not going to do something. Is the government's failure to build a road a challengeable agency action or inaction under the APA? I mean, could someone come in and say they didn't build a road through this national forest, therefore I can challenge the application of the roadless rule? I think the government there would say, the fact that's not really inaction, that's just non-action. We didn't do anything, and there's nothing to challenge there. And similarly, if an agency sets a standard, such as an emissions standard or an exposure standard for a chemical, is there then an as-applied challenge when, what that means is actually that private entities are going to be maybe exposing workers to some substance, and what the standard means is that the agency won't take action against them until they exceed it. But for exposures below that level, is there any application of the regulation by the agency that can be challenged? I think it's somewhat problematic. Now, the way out in many cases may be that a lot of those standard-setting type rules are the subject of direct review statutes that call for judicial review of the issuance of a regulation in a court of appeals. And the government has at least suggested in its briefs in this case, and Justice Scalia also suggested in his dicta in National Wildlife Federation, that the existence of a direct review statute might be taken into consideration in the ripeness calculus and might support the notion that a facial rule challenge would be considered ripe even for someone who was not the regulated entity. However, you know, if you actually look at what the lower courts have done with ripeness analysis in direct review statutes, at least the D.C. Circuit has seemed to think that the Abbott Labs standard applies in direct review cases in the same way it does in APA cases in the district court. And if a more restrictive analysis were to be adopted by the Supreme Court in this case for APA purposes, I'm not so sure that the lower courts wouldn't feel that a similarly restrictive ripeness analysis applied even in direct review statutes. At least my prediction would be that would be the next battleground. So I think those are some of the stakes on the ripeness side of this case. On the standing side of the case, and I think Amanda alluded to this in her closing remarks, I think there's less at issue in this case as a legal matter. The standing issue in this case is primarily one of reviewing the declarations and finding whether they say enough about the concrete injuries that are attributable to the procedural violation to satisfy the standing analysis that the court has announced in previous cases. There's also sort of a very case-specific question in this instance about whether the timing of certain of the affidavits that were filed in connection with post-trial motions or post-judgment motions permits them to be considered for purposes of the standing analysis. And the government has actually in its latest filing, in its reply brief, not even argued that those affidavits that were filed in connection with the government's motion for a stay pending appeal in the district court, the government hasn't even argued really that those would be inadequate to support standing because they do fairly specifically allege that members of the groups use other national forests that are likely to involve timber sales where these where the rule not allowing notice and comment will be applied. They've just said those affidavits were filed too late to be considered. And that is something that I think doesn't have a lot of impact outside of the particular circumstances of this case. There is some language in the Ninth Circuit's opinion that, as Amanda indicated, could be read to suggest that the court there was holding that a mere procedural injury is enough for standing. We're not arguing that in the Supreme Court because we feel like the Supreme Court's decisions make that a very difficult argument to sustain, and that in procedural rights cases, the decisions tend to suggest that one needs to show that the absence of the required procedures will result in a concrete on-the-ground injury to one's tangible interest in the use of some particular environmental resource or area. And so our submission in this case is simply that we meet the standards that have been applied in other cases. And then I really need to let Damian have his say. But there is a remaining issue in this case, which is the scope of relief. The court's the court at the district court level issued a nationwide injunction against this regulation, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed it using some language that, again, suggested that that their view was that the APA's requirement that the court set aside agency action that it finds to be unlawful means that a nationwide injunction is necessary in every case where a regulation is held to be unlawful. And again, we haven't argued in the Supreme Court that a nationwide injunction is necessarily required in every case where a regulation is held to be unlawful. What we have, argued based on what the Supreme Court has in the past said about the subject, which is very little, and what other courts of appeals and district courts have said, is that a nationwide injunction is certainly appropriate and authorized by the APA's language that says a court may set aside an agency action that it finds to be invalid, and that whether the equities justify that in a particular case depends on whether it's necessary to afford complete relief to the parties against the injuries that make the case a ripe one and on which they've relied for standing. And here, where we have plaintiffs with interests in the use of national forests across the country, and where these regulations are being applied throughout the country, the court really can't supply us with complete relief unless it grants a nationwide injunction. And given the other equitable factors, including the clarity of the incompatibility of these regulations with the substantive law, which they directly contradict, there isn't really much of an interest on the other side that counsels anything less sweeping than setting aside these regulations nationwide. So with that, I'll let Damian have his say, although I'll precede it with the statement that interestingly enough, although the Pacific Legal Foundation filed an amicus brief that says it's on the government side in this case, we really are largely in agreement with their analysis of the ripeness issue in the case.
Thank you, Scott. Scott had mentioned that this is an abstract case, and I think my little graphic here probably proves the point. It may also prove that public interest attorneys may have too much time on their hands, and that we use Greek variables gratuitously. But in any event, this is my attempt to show, and obviously in the back you can't see the words, so I'll explain it, but this is my attempt to show our idea of the ripeness analysis. And Scott had given an introduction to that to say that we think that really the best way to look at this case and ripeness in general is a sliding scale or balancing analysis between two important factors, that being fitness for judicial review and harm to the parties if review is withheld. And the first point I want to make is, you see in the bottom left-hand corner, we talk about issues being indeterminate. And I think it's important to bear in mind that once we start talking about ripeness in the context of this case, we're already presupposing the existence of Article III standing. So, I think we can then be a little more relaxed in our assessment as to, well, what is the injury and is it actually concrete and what have you. I mean, we're talking about prudential ripeness, so we can be a little more relaxed in that regard. The center line there is what I call the ripeness line. And the whole point is your case is ripe if you get above that line. So the most important point to draw is that on the left-hand side, fitness for judicial review, so case alpha there, you have a case that is somewhat sharpened in the legal issues presented, but not perhaps on its own enough for the court to exercise judicial review. But you go over to the next step, and then you can see that, well, there is significant harm to the parties if, in fact, judicial review is withheld. And thus, if you add both of those factors together, you do get what I would consider to be a ripe case, a prudentially ripe case, obviously also a constitutionally ripe case. Now, the second case, the beta case there, is just an example of what I think it means to have a two-step analysis for Abbott Labs, and that is that if you have a case that is one, as Scott mentioned, that, say, contends that that there is a jurisdictional error in the statute, or that there was notice and comment error, such that you could never conceive of the regulation being appropriately applied or legally applied or constitutionally applied, then my goodness, that is in fact a ripe case, and there should be really no attention paid at all to the question of harm to the parties. If there were, then I think you would sort of be turning Abbott Labs into kind of on its head, because then you would start using the absence of harm to deny judicial review, whereas it seems to me that the whole point of having a factor about harm to parties is to rely upon that to bootstrap up a case into a ripe case that otherwise might be unripe just based upon the status of the record or the issues presented. And then the last case there is just an example of what I would consider to be an unripe case, essentially one where it needs more factual development and the harm to parties is not significant enough to justify judicial review. Now, I will say that our amicus brief in this case that we filed was actually in support of neither party, but it is certainly true, as Scott mentioned, that this ripeness analysis is one that I think everybody should be interested in, regardless of one's position sort of ideologically in terms of environmental law or administrative law in general, because it is one that pretty much goes to the very heart of seeking effective judicial review and judicial remedies for injured parties. And I also agree with Amanda that I believe that the government's presentation of this case goes significantly beyond, I believe, what the Supreme Court has held with respect to rightness. And I believe that a more relaxed approach to rightness is not only appropriate, but is in fact supported by the case law. And to give you one other example, Scott had mentioned the roadless rule. We're currently involved in two appeals in the Ninth Circuit concerning, which in fact will be heard next month, concerning a policy promulgated by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And the government has argued in this briefing that we cannot seek direct review of this policy, notwithstanding the fact that it has already been applied in concrete instances, for the same reasons that the government here argues that one cannot seek review of the regulations at issue, because the regulations themselves are not the appropriate vehicle or unit for judicial review. So I certainly think that the government has every interest in pursuing the theory, and it is one that is cross-cutting and one that I believe is of interest to anybody involved in environmental law or administrative law in general. And I do think that not only the line that Scott mentioned with respect to the NWF case, Justice Scalia's dictum on when ripeness is how ripeness should be handled, not only could you say it's dicta, but I think that even as dicta, it doesn't go as far as the government has said it does, because he qualifies in his statement there what is fit for review and what isn't. He says, absent such a provision, however, a regulation is not ordinarily considered the type of agency action ripe for judicial review unless the controversy has been fleshed out. And so I think the importance of the adverb ordinarily is extraordinarily important in that I don't believe that even that case could be couched into supporting what in any respect is a draconian analysis of rightness that the government has offered here. And one last point that I wanted to make, although we didn't address it in our amicus brief and hasn't really been touched upon much here, the question of a nationwide injunction, which again is really a cross-cutting issue and one I think of importance to anyone involved in this branch of the law, and that is that if you accept the idea of a facial challenge, then it's difficult to conceive of what would be the appropriate remedy other than vacatur and nationwide injunction, especially if your argument is that there is some profound defect with the way the regulation was enacted. If you're saying that the authorizing statute, say in this case the ARA, does not allow for an implementation regulation that exempts certain significant certain activities that may have a significant impact on the environment. If that's the contention, and if that's true, then it seems as if there is no set of circumstances under which the government could ever apply these regulations properly, for no other reason than that the authorizing statute, for example, in this case the ARA, doesn't allow any other type of regulation to be implemented other than one that is one that would only allow certain types of actions to go forward without being subject to administrative appeal. So I also believe that the, just as in ripeness, I think the attitude of the government in this case towards the nationwide injunction one is a little bit contrived and an attempt to set up the issue in a way that that sort of smacks of the study and not too much of the courtroom. And I think that should the court address it, I would suspect that it would go with the respondents on that as well as with the ripeness issue.
Well, thanks. I don't know. I have a few questions, and before we open it up to the audience, I was wondering if any of our panelists wanted to respond to any particular points raised by each other or not.
I have one further thought, which is, even if you think that the Scalia's dicta means what it says, that pre-enforcement review is presumptively unavailable, I just want to reiterate, this isn't a pre-enforcement case. And so even if, it seems to me there is a question that the court will eventually have to address, but that it need not and really cannot address in this case, which is if you want to bring a facial challenge, how long do you have to wait to bring it? Do you have to wait until regulations like this have been applied at least in some circumstance, maybe affecting you, maybe not affecting you, but at least some circumstance so you can see how the application works? In this case, it was applied in that circumstance, so there's no occasion for the court to say whether that application was necessary or not. All the court needs to say here is this is ripe or this wasn't. But I do think that there's a case that's sort of begging eventually to be answered, which is, you know, if you have a facial challenge like this, can you, in the absence of a statutory provision saying, you know, bring your challenge immediately, can you bring it immediately, or do you need to wait for an application like this? Fortuitously here, the respondents waited, so they didn't pose that issue. But.
And I had something that is somewhat related to that point and also to Damien's last comments about the nationwide injunction. And first, you know, just so that, you know, unfortunately or unfortunately, we don't have anybody up here reflecting the other side of the ripeness issue or the nationwide injunction issue. The one point that I think people ought to understand as to what's driving the government here, you know, Damien says, well, if the conclusion is that this statute is just, or this regulation is just invalid, facially because of a procedural defect or a substantive defect of incompatibility with the underlying statutory standard, you know, why shouldn't the court enjoin it across the board since the significance of its ruling is that it can never be validly applied? What the government is countering that with is that they really have an interest in relitigating that issue in other courts. So the fact that a district court in California or even a regional court of appeals has reached that conclusion that the regulation is invalid on its face, in their view, should not disable them from arguing that same issue in other jurisdictions, and if a conflict develops, then taking the issue up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, one of the reasons what they would say in response to Amanda's point earlier about, well, why didn't they take the merits up to the Supreme Court? They said, well, there was no conflict on them. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit's ruling upholding the nationwide injunction made it essentially impossible for there ever to develop a conflict. So, you know, part of their argument is they ought to be able to relitigate issues absent a direct review statute that basically says Congress has judged that this issue should only be decided once. And I think our view is because the Supreme Court has actually recognized that that relitigation issue or interest is in some circumstances a legitimate interest of the government, our response to that is simply that it isn't, you know, it isn't always the interest that should prevail, and especially if you have a group of plaintiffs who are suffering injury nationwide, they may require a nationwide injunction for redress. And so that the court can balance that, but it is not disabled from issuing a nationwide injunction. But, you know, fundamentally what the government is saying in this case is, well, a nationwide injunction isn't appropriate because a facial challenge isn't appropriate. And I think their view is it's never appropriate. And even under those circumstances where they have conceded that a, quote, pre-enforcement challenge can be brought, if you comb their footnotes, they seem to be suggesting that a regulated entity that maybe is, so it's been subject to a regulation that says you can't do this, and if you do it, you know, you'll face a fine of X thousand dollars per day that you're in violation. You know, the government says, well, that person does actually suffer hardship if they can't get pre-enforcement review, because otherwise they have to go and violate the statute in order for an as-applied challenge to arise, and then, you know, if they lose, they're out of luck. They have to pay thousands of dollars. But even in those cases, I think the government is saying that entity or that person can only get an injunction against the application of the regulation to them. At least that's the most aggressive iteration of their position. So it may actually be that you know, even regulated industries have something to fear from this decision, because the scope of the kinds of challenges that they may be able to bring, if the government were correct, would be drastically reduced.
I just wanted to pose a quick question on standing. As we sort of discussed in this panel and as the briefs reflect, this case doesn't really go all that much into the standing issue except for some disagreement over the identification of future site-specific projects and such. But we all know the Supreme Court is fairly interested in standing. You have Justice Scalia's writings on the topic. You have Chief Justice Roberts' dissent in the Massachusetts EPA case. So given that, as the brief authored by Amanda on behalf of the law professors points out, the Supreme Court never really has before squarely addressed the issue of standing to bring a facial challenge to regulations. Does anyone see the court sort of reaching out on this issue in its opinion, notwithstanding the sort of the mainstream issues presented in this case?
I guess to me, it seems most likely that they would decide the case on standing grounds if they wanted to decide it narrowly rather than broadly. And I mean, I think that's quite possible in this case that, you know, somebody might parse the affidavits and say, well, this doesn't go quite far enough in identifying a specific project or a specific area where this person believes that these regulations would be applied. And you know, if the court ended up doing that, it would be, you know, other than the fact that these plaintiffs would lose this case in a way that I don't think they should lose it, because I think their affidavits really are adequate. But it wouldn't be a big event, you know, outside of this case. It would just be a cautionary tale about, you know, it would be one more case to read about what you better include in your affidavits. And I don't think, though, that it looks to me like a case where somebody would really push the ball on the standing side. If they want to push the law, I think they're going to push it on the ripeness and the scope of relief. But
one question that struck me is, do you think that there's a way for the court to resolve the case on negatively, obviously on standing grounds, without having to hold that the reviewable unit is the Burnt Ridge project?
Well, I mean, that would be how, I mean, if you said that, you know, you have to establish standing related to some specific application, that would basically just be another way of reaching the result the government wants to reach on rankness. But, you know, I don't think that's the only way that they could rule against these plaintiffs on standing. I mean, the other way to do it would be to say most of the affidavits don't count because the government argues that they were filed too late, which, I mean, I think is kind of ridiculous, but, you know, more ridiculous things perhaps have been ruled by the Supreme Court. And then, you know, that just leaves an affidavit that just doesn't say, you know, one could say it doesn't say quite enough about specific sites or specific areas. I mean, you know, I think it takes a pretty crabbed reading of the affidavits to get to that result. But I think it would be a possible outcome. I don't think that it would be a possible correct outcome.
I want to add one thing to that, which is that the court issued a decision this spring, Davis v. FEC, which was a review of the Millionaires Amendment to the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. That amendment says that if you are running against a millionaire who's self-financed in their campaign, then that person has to make all sorts of disclosures about their own spending, and your own spending limits are upped as a result. Davis is a millionaire, a self-financed candidate for House. He was a self-financed candidate for House in the 2006 election, and at the time he challenged the Millionaires Amendment as violating the First Amendment because it forced him to do all sorts of disclosures, and then it was going to allow his opponent to raise more money than he, essentially, or to, you know, be subject to less stringent caps. In the meantime, as the case is moving through the court, his election winds up, essentially. So his election is over by the time the court hears the challenge to the Millionaires Amendment, and the question is whether, much like this case, the question is whether the resolution of his challenge in the context of his election is moot, or he loses standing as a result of the election winding up. And the court says quite clearly on the standing point, on the mootness point, it says this is an issue capable of resolution but evading relief, essentially. So it's not quite the same as this case. It's something that is not moot because it's likely to come up in every election cycle, and yet it will evade review because it will always outlast that election cycle, essentially. So the mootness analysis is less relevant to this case. But the standing analysis in that case, the court says he established standing at the time his case was filed, and standing is about whether you have established injury in fact at the time your case is filed. And mootness is about whether the case is over, essentially, by the time we hear it. The court reiterates, as I said, that standing is an initial analysis, essentially. And I think that helps the plaintiffs here because, of course, at the time that they filed the case, the Burnt Ridge controversy is live. And so the fact that they're premising their standing in part on that live controversy, I don't think, again, under Lyons, the chokehold case, I don't think that would be enough for a facial challenge. But I think the fact that they can rely in part on Burnt Ridge and in part on their claims about other likely injuries in other national forests makes it less likely that the court is going to, you know, reach out and say anything sweeping on standing here.
I think at this point we'd like to open it up to questions from the audience. I see one in the back.
I was struck by the fact that none of you mentioned Ohio Forestry. I was struck by it because, of course, unlike Lujan, it is a real case with a real holding that appears to apply Scalia's analysis in the context of a real situation. I was also struck, and I have not, I confess, read the Supreme Court briefs in this case, but in Ohio Forestry, the court articulated a third factor in the Abbott Labs analysis, which is the inconvenience to the government, the interference with the government's interest in not having its regulations or its policymaking prematurely interfered with by the court. I don't know whether that reflects a long-term shift, because the court has not come back to that analysis, in the way the court views rightness, but I assume the government would try to take advantage of it here, since they'd be arguing something about interference with their interest in having, you know, pre-enforcement review until it's completely applied. 5, that sort of thing. Was that, in fact, addressed in the briefs, and is that a separate factor you're concerned about?
Well, I mean, Ohio Forestry is certainly addressed in the briefs, and as to whether it transformed it from a two-part analysis to a three-part analysis, I mean, you know, I think that sometimes people get a little hung up on whether tests have, you know, X number of parts or Y number of parts. The way I read Ohio Forestry, and particularly then looking back to the fact that, as you say, in subsequent cases, the court hasn't referred to it as having changed the number of parts of the test, is that the interest of the government in not having its proceedings interfered with prematurely is really part and parcel of the question of fitness for review. You know, is this an action where the government has come to rest and, you know, taken a completed action that presents legal issues that are squarely appropriate for review now, or is there still some ongoing deliberative process that isn't over yet, and therefore, you know, we haven't really come to the point where there's a crystallized issue? That's how I saw it, and that's how I think we argued it. And I don't think that the government, in its briefs, would probably disagree with that, you know, I don't think they would take the view, although obviously they're not here to answer the question, that you know, it's wrong to view that as part and parcel of the fitness for review rather than as a separate prong, if you will. And then beyond that, I think, you know, more generally, the way we read Ohio Forestry is that, you know, what was going on there was a document that was at a pretty high level of abstraction and that didn't yet, you know, really sort of resolve key issues that made it fit for review yet. So the court didn't, I think, really have to get into the question of, well, if you have something that is clearly fit for review, what is the nature of the hardship, if any, that is needed to make a challenge ripe? And actually, if you look at what I think that's Justice Thomas, if I'm not mistaken, but I may be wrong, but what he says about the kinds of things that qualify as hardship, you know, one of the things he says is if the government's going to be cutting trees down without giving you a chance to be heard on the question, which is, you know, in our view, precisely what's posed by this case. So, you know, I don't think this, and even if I thought it, I'm not sure I would say it, but I don't think Ohio Forestry, you know, adopts the government's view as presented in its brief of what it thinks Justice Scalia was saying in WF, which is basically that, you know, you can't get facial review unless you're a regulated entity. I think there's a little bit in Ohio Forestry for everybody to argue about, and because of its fact-specific nature, I don't think that Ohio Forestry really changed or advanced the law of ripeness in the same way that a ruling in the government's favor in this case would.
The government interest that's explored in Ohio Forestry really is the interest in taking this broad forest management plan and being able to apply it with some leeway, essentially, on the ground to individual road cutting projects and things like that. So they say this is a very broad nebulous forest management plan that applies forest-wide. We have no idea yet, and frankly the agency need not have any idea yet, how it's going to apply that plan to particular sites. And so the government's interest is to sort of preserve its flexibility as long as possible until a particular site-specific decision needs to be made. The government doesn't have a parallel argument here, really. I mean, I think it would have a hard time articulating a cognizable interest in avoiding review of the question whether these regulations are patently inconsistent with the ARA. I mean, it can't say, to the extent that it says this, what it says is, although the regulations, and they do say this, although the regulations look broad, and they look like we're going to cut off notice and comment and cut off review in a broad swath of circumstances, in fact, we're really only going to apply this to, you know, lawn mowing operations and other very small decisions made in the forests. And so, we are actually going to apply it more narrowly than it appears to be written. So I guess they sort of get at that question, but I'll stop there.
We have others?
For those who don't know me, I'm Glenn Tugamelli, with those judges. I was actually, I guess, like fourth chair in the NWF case, Supreme Court level. And this is a couple of minor points about that. The land withdrawal review program was actually the government's term. I mean, they treated it as a program. It wasn't just something we invented, just found in the rent. There were thousands of these actions taken under a coordinated approach where they were systematically going through and eliminating land withdrawals, reviewing land withdrawals, which is withdrawal from the act, from the operation of things like the Mining Act, which would allow gold mining claims to go in, protecting the land. These protections were being removed across the country. There also was an issue about, in that case, ironically, about lateness filing of affidavits, which was not an issue until the judge actually, after we had standing upheld, basically, said, well, gee, can we have briefing on that? And we provided briefing with affidavits, which were then a little too late, even though the issue hadn't really been raised until at the argument. But more importantly, I'm interested in your thoughts about the application of these rules to regulated entities and to the public more broadly. First of all, it seems like the Massachusetts versus EPA Roberts case is a great example of how the ruling in that area is not potentially, if that had been a majority, to take that issue out of the judicial sphere. What it would be, if he had succeeded there, would be to say that the public couldn't challenge inadequate action to address global warming that violates the Clean Air Act, but the industry always could, because they could always say it's going to cost $100, or it's going to cost $200, or whatever it is. So it would be a very one-sided thing. Same thing I guess you suggested here, that this could end up being a result. There's also, I litigated under the Surface Mining Control Regulation Act, and there is a statute saying you've got to challenge national rules in the 50 days, actually in the district court, or else you can't. And there have been efforts to change those statutes in Congress across the board to say basically in certain contexts it opens up rates to be challenged any time. And there really has been opposition more broadly than the public interest community, because there's a recognition that those serve an interest of having certainty for everybody, including the regulated entities, that they know that if there was no challenge filed within 60 days, then this is the regulation they're going to be operating under. Or if there was one filed and it's resolved, then that is the rule, whatever they come out and say. So that also plays into this, because whatever could happen here could actually be kind of a Pyrrhic victory, where you end up with a ruling basically that says that results in there not being certainty as to what the regulatory scheme is in a wide variety of context. But I'm just interested in any of your views on the idea of the level playing field or the application of these rules across the board. It seems to me that this potential use, as with NWF, of definition of agency action, of rightness, in this case of standing potentially in the Massachusetts for EPA case, to basically say only one side is going to be able to challenge these in a practical matter or a legal matter.
Can I just take a first crack at that and then leave others? I mean, Glenn, first of all, your comments about NWF sort of reveal the difference between what a case really is and what it becomes after the Supreme Court gets to it. I mean, in reality, there was a land withdrawal program, but, in the Supreme Court's parlance, it was just, a non-action that you sought to use as a label for a bunch of different things that you wanted to challenge. So, I mean, for us in arguing about what the case means, we accept what the Supreme Court said rather than what was literally true in the underlying case. And you know, then in terms of the lateness of affidavits, obviously the government has relied on that holding. The difference between the two cases is, in our case, the district court didn't exclude our affidavits. In fact, you know, we think it relied on them in denying the government its stay. So there was no suggestion that they're not actually part of the record, whereas the affidavits in NWF, I believe, were stricken. But then, you know, to get to your more broad questions, I mean, first, it's absolutely true that the effect here would be, as would the effect of Justice Roberts' standing views in Mass v. EPA and a lot of the kinds of positions that are taken by, you know, the Justice Department and some of the more conservative judges, you know, usually not in majorities yet, would be to make it a very one-sided situation. And you know, it's similar to what we saw in the case that was the subject of a previous ELI thing, the tire pressure monitoring decision of the D.C. Circuit about statistical injury. I mean, you know, everybody knows that if you have inadequate safety rules, you know, people are going to be hurt, but, you know, they can't obtain standing unless they can show to the satisfaction of the D.C. Circuit now that they have a statistically appreciable likelihood of being injured, whereas the entities that are being regulated always have standing to challenge a regulation because it always, I mean, any regulation by its nature tells them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think that, frankly, the courts would say, even if it doesn't cost them any money, just by virtue of the fact that they are being compelled to do something they may not want to do, that's a sufficient injury to give them standing. This would be, the ripeness arguments here would similarly be, you know, kind of a one-way ratchet in which, you know, the kinds of people that I represent and that you represent would have these arguments invoked against them. Regulated entities, I think, would always be able to show ripeness at some level, although, as I mentioned, the government might try to narrow the relief available to them, but they certainly would have an easier time than we would.
By the way, just a quick follow-up on your point about the cost of money. I was actually had a D.C. Circuit case where I was arguing for NWF intervener defendant, and the issue involved whether coal mining industry would be regulated by state or federal government in this context. And at oral argument, I think it was Centel asked the industry, well, where's your standing? And resulted in total confusion, saying, well literally the answer was, well, of course we have standing, we're the industry. And that was the best you could come up with at the oral argument. Finally, they kind of had mercy, and they said, well, let's have post-argument briefing on that issue. And sort of ended up sort of reluctantly upholding standing, but they did uphold standing in that case, even though there really wasn't a showing of one regulation would be tougher or whatever, just sort of different, and that was good enough. So there was at least raised by Centel, but it was, the reaction showed me that that's something that the industry didn't even think about.
Do you have thoughts? I'm curious what that.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned before, we believe that certainly the issues in this case, with regard to ripeness in particular, are ones that would have a profoundly negative effect across the board. And I don't believe that if the court were to accept the government's conception of ripeness, that there would be necessarily any sort of exemption or special provision for regulated parties. I think really everybody would be put in a much more difficult position. I mean, arguably some groups more difficult than others, but it would be a bad day for really anybody who wants to seek judicial review in an effective manner of agency regulation. And the same thing, I think, applies to the issue of the scope of injunctive relief. More broadly speaking, in terms of standing, I mean, I think the courts will always consider something like, you know, economic injury to be more palatable for purposes of satisfying the injury prong, but you always have questions of causation and redress, which, regardless of the nature of the injury, may still be problematic, particularly in, say, the global warming context for the master EPA opinion. So, at least in terms of the issues defended in this case, I suppose, you know, from an advocate's perspective from my side, sure, it would be great if it only had a one-sided application, but I honestly don't think that would be the case here, and that in part explains why we believe that the respondent's notion of ripeness here is the correct one.
I had one further thought, which is that Scalia actually says in NWF, I believe, something that alludes to this difference, and his point, which taken most literally, I think is actually a valid one, is that, you know, regulated entities can show that they themselves are directly affected by a regulation. And, you know, taking the opposite extreme, I think we basically all agree that, you know, the mere fact of having read a regulation and not liking it shouldn't be enough to give you standing to get into court to challenge it. You have to show that you are the right plaintiff in some way. You're affected yourself, you're representing some people who are affected, some concrete interest of yours is affected by this regulation. And you can see why there's some difficulty drawing the line in between those two extremes, right? Because an unregulated third party that is merely interested in the regulation, it's hard to figure out how to draw a precise line as to how much of a concrete interest they should have before they can file suit. What's interesting in this case is that Scalia's rationale for setting up that difference, in part at least, is that unregulated third parties in most circumstances are not necessarily complaining about the government action, or at least they're not directly complaining about the government action. They're complaining about the government's the effect of the government action on some other party that is not before the court. And so there's a question about how this other party is going to respond to the government's regulation. And the court suggests, and you can think what you want about this, but the court suggests that in those cases, there's some concern about saying that this unregulated party has standing. So for example, in the tire pressure case, the regulation operates on the tire manufacturers. To some extent, the injuries that the public citizen was complaining about are going to depend not just on the regulation, but on how the auto industry responds to that regulation. And so Scalia says there's some concern about letting this case go forward without representation from the regulated entities. That is not true in this case, because the regulations that are being challenged here are procedural regulations they're regulations that withdraw procedural rights from these respondents. So there's a statute that purports to give these respondents procedural rights, and these regulations operate directly on these respondents to withdraw those procedural rights. So this concern about a nebulous question of how some party not before the court is going to respond to the regulations is not as relevant in this case.
There was one aspect of what you said, Glenn, that I also wanted to comment on, your last point about, you know, the interests of certainty and, you know, the benefits of actually getting global rule challenges resolved early. One thing that it made me think of is that, you know, in other contexts, the government actually often takes the litigation position that those interests should predominate, so that, for example, in a number of cases, people have purported to challenge regulations, the government has said, well, you know, the action that you're challenging was the promulgation of the regulation, and that happened more than 6 years ago, so the general statute of limitations for suits against the government, which is applicable to district court APA actions, has run. And, you know, basically, their position here would, I think, take away that kind of a repose argument from them, ironically, because, you know, if they succeed here, the person would always be able to say, listen, you know, I couldn't have brought this suit at the time the regulation was promulgated. I can only bring it once it was applied. And there's even been a little bit of that under direct review statutes, you know, because the D.C. Circuit says even in a direct review case where there's a 60-day time limit or a 59-day time limit, sometimes, you know, if it wasn't ripe for one reason or another, you know, that sort of goes by the boards. And so there is sometimes some lingering uncertainty even in direct review cases about whether somebody might later be able to come in and say, well, we couldn't seek review earlier, but we can now. But, you know, I think that's been a pretty rare set of circumstances, and most people feel like if you've got a challenge to a statute that is reviewable under one of these direct review provisions, you better bring it within 60 days. And then, you know, if they say it's not right, then you'll be able to bring it later, maybe. But, you know, you wouldn't want to take your chances on not bringing it. But, you know, the government's position here, I think, would throw a lot more of that up for grabs. And, you know, that's why we think, as Damian pointed out, that you know, there are a lot of benefits when these are challenges that don't depend on the application of a regulation to particular circumstances, to just getting it resolved and you know, getting an order one way or another, and the rule's either valid or it's not. You know, that's not the model, obviously, that the government favors for judicial review of regulations.
But one other quick, what about national injunctions both ways? I mean, you can have times where one district judge says you have to do it, but otherwise you can't.
Well, that's actually going on right now. And, you know, the question there is, first of all, if there's already an injunction in place, you know, the second court, as a normal matter of comedy, you know, normally wouldn't issue a contradictory injunction, but it does occasionally happen.
We have two more questions. The gentleman here, and then Dan, I think you had a question.
Thanks.
As well.
Professor, I'm Bob Cook from BNA. Hi.
Hi.
Having scoured the brief, did you discern any actual intent by DOJ to put a muzzle on environmental watchdog groups?
Oh. I think that they are asking for a rule that frankly is, you know, and the language that they use is the Supreme Court has quote unquote repeatedly held, and yet I think they're asking for a rule that is novel and sweeping, and I think they're aware of the implications of that rule.
Thank you.
Stop there.
I had Dan Tran here at the Institute. I had two completely unrelated questions. There's just time for one, but on the issue, I'm still a little bit confused on this issue of the nationwide injunction. I mean, it's just the court maybe use the wrong term, but obviously an injunction is more than simply invalidating something under, like I've seen with the Chevron analysis. And the government seems to have somewhat of a valid point in saying if it's enjoined from using the reg at all, there's no way it can even, I mean, another district court isn't bound by one other district court's opinion or judgment. On the other hand, one district court's injunction of a regulation that no other court can even hear anymore because it's not being used because it's enjoined does seem to be a little bit beyond jurisdiction. So it seems like the government has a stronger position there than the panelists have made it out to be. And my second question, unrelated, is would some sort of statute giving jurisdiction over claims that would have otherwise been unripe under the, you know, the judicial doctrines of ripeness, would that stand up to constitutional scrutiny, or would there be a possibility? I mean, is that even in the works? And secondly, if something like that were passed, would it face a strong constitutional challenge on the basis of Article 3 against the controversy standards? And that's open for anybody.
I'll stick up for the government's view on the nationwide injunction. There's a reason why I didn't cover it in our brief. I think the district court potentially did overreach, particularly because they didn't engage in a balancing of the equities or anything. I think they intended to say these rules are invalid and leave it at that and let other courts conclude the scope of that holding, whether to follow it, whether not to follow it, whether you're bound by it, whether you're not. But instead, they put it in terms of a nationwide injunction, and the implication, obviously, is that the government could be held in contempt if it tries to rely on the rules in a different circuit, which I think that's potentially problematic without a balancing of the equities.
Well, I mean, first, just as a point of clarification, I think actually the district court did balance the equities.
Okay.
The Ninth Circuit in its decision certainly didn't pay a lot of attention to that, and you know, its analysis of the issue was quite limited. But you know, it is right, as you say, that the government has some interests. I certainly don't think, though, that the issue is lack of jurisdiction of the district court. You know, the first of all, I mean, as to you know, when you say jurisdiction, certainly the party is before the court, and the court has authority to issue an order that binds that party, regardless of where that party takes an action. I mean, you know, if in any lawsuit, if I sue the defendant for injunctive relief and there's personal jurisdiction, the injunction against that defendant can operate wherever the defendant ultimately goes. And I think also that the Administrative Procedure Act, in its authorization to set aside regulations, which, you know, I think means something more active than just saying, in my opinion, this regulation is invalid. It means, you know, saying, you can't carry this regulation out. You know, that gives the court authority, but it is also the case that the court's authority under the APA is supposed to be governed by equitable principles. So some balancing is necessary. As to your second point, which Amanda didn't address, I think, you know, the government's view in this case on ripeness is a prudential ripeness argument. And for that reason, if a court were to say, I mean, if a legislature were to say that this court has is being given authority to rule on regulations without regard to whether they meet, you know, the Abbott Labs type of test for ripeness, it certainly has the ability to do that. What it can't dispense with are, you know, the requisites of an Article III case or controversy, which require in the ripeness area really not much more than Article III standing does. You have to show an injury that is imminent and sufficiently imminent. And those courts that have looked at the question of the relationship between Article III ripeness and prudential ripeness have basically said, you know, all this Abbott Labs stuff is prudential ripeness. The Article III ripeness requirement is a sufficiently imminent injury, and that's the same as the standing requirement for Article III.
Do we have anything else from the audience? I'd like to thank our panelists very much for a really engaging discussion.